Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford, the Rudy Sarge.
Hey there, this is Steve Hackett.
Hey, folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph.
And we're talking rock with Dave and Shane. Hey!
Screaming at the Sky is the album, studio album number 8. And Chris from Blackstone Cherry is joining us from that wonderful, fabulous Kentucky quartet, man.
Amazing.
Some cool, cool tracks are already out there. You got Out of Pocket. You got Nervous. Some really cool stuff. Chris, how you doing, my brother?
I am good. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, man. We got you, dude.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Good. Yes, sir.
I was wondering.
Someone go out and come back in.
That's right. That's what you got to do.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
Yeah. Is that your spot of inspiration? Is that on your porch or backyard? I think that's where we talked to you last time, virtually. Yeah.
Yes, sir. This is my front porch. This is my little slice of heaven.
Like it, man. Dude, the stuff we've heard is heavy. I mean, the title track, like, you guys are just, you guys are firing up on all the juices here. Talk about kind of what's going into this record, the inspiration, and just how fired up you are, man.
Man, I mean, the last 3 years have been different, I think is a nice way of putting it. but no, man, I mean, the world you're living in and the things that you're living with and going through, all that stuff shapes everything you're doing. And I think for all the hell we went through, we came up with a hell of a record, I think, I think you can tell though that there's been some things we've gone through and there's some lessons we've learned and life that we've lived. And these songs show all of that.
Yeah. This is hard. Everything I'm hearing, we listened to the whole record last night, thanks to Mascot Records. The whole record just cooks very hard. I don't really hear a ballad on there. Towards the end of the record, it gets a little more mellow, but how would you describe that? I guess all that pent up rage, I guess, that we've had is kind of coming out on vinyl here.
Yeah, man, it just, it's odd. It's, I've always considered records a snapshot or like a timestamp, and that timestamp starts when you stop making the record before that, when you turn in the masters of that record, right? So when we turned in the masters of The Human Condition, day one life started over to create Screaming at the Sky. That's my mentality of, that record's finished. So anything that you experience from that time till you finish making the next one is what accumulates and ends up pouring out of you and into these songs, So it was a lot, man. You went through the craziest change I've ever seen in the world. For people my age and even people older, unless you live through the Depression or, some other crazy things, that was the wildest thing I think we've ever seen worldwide, then you go, or at least, I'm saying people in our age group that you've actually lived through it. Then, obviously our band went through a change, and then within a couple months of our band going through a change, my dad passed, and it was one hell of a learning experience for a while, and hell yeah, I was pissed off about a lot of stuff, I was mad because the world couldn't be what it was, and what time I did have with my dad, we couldn't do all the things we wanted to because the state the world was in, like little stuff like that, and all that eventually starts to come out, one way or another. At some point, you have to deal with the way you grieve things. And something doesn't have to die to grieve it, It could just be taken away from you for you to grieve it. I mean, dude, it was being a professional musician, a professional entertainer for the last longer than I've not been. I've been doing this since I was 17 years old, getting paid to play music. And for that to be taken away, there was a damn grieving process, man. I'm just sitting here on the porch going, what is the worth to to my life? What is the worth to, you know? And then at that same time, you start looking around and then you start having to become grateful for the things that, that, you know, you just kind of oversight sometimes. But it, this record, you know, there's a couple songs, I guess the closest thing to a ballad on it would be Here's to the Hopeless. You know, and that's one of my favorites. And then Raindrops on a Rose is probably the only other song that would get anywhere near ballad status for this record. The rest of it is just, you know, foot stomping, fist pumping, rock and roll. But, you know, man, it's, yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it. There's a lot of pent up feelings that just came out full force on this record, you know?
Yeah. I didn't feel like it was that long ago, does it, Brother Shane? Maybe, I guess, was it a year ago or so? But it,
about
it
feels, a year, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like maybe just a few months ago. But I know you, Chris, you were talking about, you know, you really opened up about some of your personal struggles with, like, depression and just stuff you had, you had gone through. And I imagine that's just, this record's, it's just a continue of that outpouring. Is it fair to say?
100%, man. I mean, you know, we all write together, but the lyrics that I contribute, you know, I'm not real good at, you know, anymore anyway. I'm not real good at like story songs or, you know, I mean, I can help with stuff like that, but it's the stuff that seems to come out of me lyrically is just more life stuff, you know, and things like that, you know, and it, but that's where I think my honesty comes in as a good thing, you know, like our manager, Vinny, he told me one time, cause I was like, man, I'm not trying to make anybody think, you know, this, he's like, dude, he's like, Chris, your problem is you're so honest. It's almost a fault sometimes because you'll tell somebody the truth when they don't need to hear it. And I'm like, well, I get that, but you know, man, it's the stuff that comes out of me is stuff that I've lived or understand, you know, it, I'm not real good with happy songs pretty much, you know, it's, it just, but dude, that's where, you know, that's what the beauty of having a band is and truly being a band, you know, is you got three other guys in there that are all equally talented songwriters, you know, we're a true fucking team, man. It's like, it takes all of us to do this thing and come in with this stuff, you know, and we all get in there and we blend it together and some of the crazy shit that comes out of my mouth that I'm thinking of for a liner, like, what if you said it this way, you know, and it's, but no, man, it's, you know, I think for the first time ever, it feels like we really just stripped it down and bared our souls in these songs and the way we wrote them, you know?
Really,
and we tried not to overproduce the record either. We wanted it to be fairly raw and in your face, you know. It's, we didn't do a lot of doubling up on guitars and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, no, it's raw. It sounds like right there, man. You guys did a beautiful job.
Thank you.
You guys did something really cool on this record. You tracked the album at the Plaza Theater in Glasgow, Kentucky. It's a old venue, if people don't know, 1934, has unbelievable acoustics. What did you, how much did that play into that sound that you were just talking about, and why did you guys decide to record them?
So the whole thought process was, we play shows at that venue, so we know the venue, you know, we know what it sounds like, and it never fails. Every time we set up to do a show there, the drums get set up, and before they even turn them on through the PA, you can crack the snare drum and you're just like, holy shit, this is like this is like God's reverb chamber right here, man. This room is amazing. And we were thinking about places to track drums because we had already decided we wanted to track the guitars, vocals, and bass at John Fred's house because we've all got, you know, some pretty nice equipment for studio gear we've acquired over the years. And we were trying to think of somewhere to do drums, and we had either tracked in or one of us had worked in some form or fashion, all the studios in the area pretty much, or at least really close to us, because we don't want to travel very far to record a record. We want to go back home to our kids and dogs every night and lay down in a bed with our wife and, you know, get up and do it over again the next day when we're making a record. We spend our time away when we're on the road. So we were talking, and we were like, well, what about the Plaza? So we rented it out, set the mics up, took a shot in the dark, really had no idea how the recording would translate. We knew that audibly in the room to your ear, it was amazing. But that doesn't always translate into microphones, because microphones can be picky little assholes sometimes, and it's never fun. But it translated, right? And it worked out, and it gave us, you know, one of my favorite and probably one of our most unique drum sounds to date on a record. And it, you know, I'd do it again in a heartbeat, you know. But we ended up tracking all the guitars and all the drums there.
Wow.
Nice, man. That's awesome. You know, you guys have, you know, so much to say on this record. And I always wonder, when you put together a set list, like, you know, Out of Pocket, Screaming at the Sky, title track, Nervous, When the Pain Comes, Show Me What It Feels Like, Roar, and it just goes on down the line. Like, how is it a painstaking process to put a track listing in order, you know, when it feels like there's so much you want to say on a record like this?
Man, this record, it wasn't as bad as some records have been in the past, where we wrote like a lot of songs and recorded a lot of songs. But this record, we were like, okay, we're going to record this many songs. We're going to do this cover, and we're going to have 11 songs on the record, which means we got to pick two for the B-sides. And it was awesome to do it that way. Like, we had a list of songs, and then we narrowed that down to the ones that we felt were the absolute best. And then we went in and recorded those, you know, and that's the 11 that are on the record, plus the What's Love Got to Do With It cover that we did. Yeah. And then also two other tracks.
That's a kick-ass cover too. I was like, you know, what was it like? How'd you guys go about picking that one? Just talk, I know you talked about it before, but just, you know, what was it about that track that just jumped out at you, man?
Dude, so we were over doing the premiere for the Royal Albert Hall DVD in London, and we were staying at the Hard Rock Hotel. I went outside to have a cigarette, came back inside. I said hey to the dudes. They were all sitting at the bar having a drink. I'm not much of a drinker, so I went upstairs, and I was like, I'm going to go to bed. So, y'all, as I was going upstairs, What's Love Got to Do With It came on. The next morning, John Fred goes, man, when you went upstairs, Tina Turner came on, and I think we ought to do a version of it. I told the guys you'd kill it singing it. So we were like, hell yeah, let's try it. So we got back to the States. Next time we went out on the road, we went out on the bus. We set the Pro Tools rig up in the back, you know, with their little iRig, whatever, and come up with a version of it, recorded it. And then, you know, we were just planning on it being, you know, an additional track for the record or deluxe edition or something. And then with Tina's passing, we were like, well, we don't want to do it and be like, oh, look at us, but we want to use this for something.
Yeah.
So we decided to put it out, and then any of the royalties that we would have received off of it are going to be all donated to domestic violence awareness. Because obviously that was huge for Tina, you know. So we're not making anything off of it. We just wanted people to hear our version of a great song by one of the greatest to ever do it, you know.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Man. What albums of hers really spoke to you? I mean, I know you love classic rock, all kinds.
Growing up. For me, honestly, my two favorite Tina songs are two of the biggest ones. It's What's Love Got to Do With It. And then, you know, dude, we walk out every night, rolling, every night. I mean, dude, it's just such an iconic performer, man. You know, like, and the greatest legs rock and roll's ever seen. Let's just be real here.
That's right.
Best damn legs rock and roll.
Straight up.
You know, I mean, let's just go. Carrie Underwood been trying to do the leg game for a long time, and she's beautiful and has great legs, but not Tina. Not Tina. Nah.
Yep.
You leave Tina's legs out of this.
Yeah, she's on another level.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You were talking about the cover. The cover art's amazing. Love the cover. Can you talk about the cover art for this record and the story behind it?
So it was done by a guy named Sam Maile, M-A-Y-L-E. And he's done a lot of stuff. He's done some stuff for Disney, for the Star Wars franchise, stuff like that. He's an incredible illustrator. And he had done some stuff for us in the past. And we just kind of, we told him the title. And we were like, you know, give us what you think, you know. And he sent us like four or five different, I think it was four renditions, maybe five, just different like quick sketches of what he thought of when he heard Screaming at the Sky. And there was one that led to the cover you see today. And, you know, everybody that sees it sees something different, and it's what I love about it. You know, for me, what drew me into it was the whole idea of letting the bad go and breathing the life to light. They're breathing the light to life. You know what I mean? So with the butterflies coming out of the mouth, that's the light, you know, that's the life being screamed into the sky. And then the tree, the dead trees falling off, but just letting everything else go, man, just live, go forward, you know? And it, I don't know, it really spoke to me in that kind of regard. And all the other guys just spoke to them in their own way as well, you know? So it's just really, really cool. And that guy's such an amazing illustrator. And I think he does a really good job of, you know, being a guy from England that completely understands what four guys from South Central Kentucky want in artwork. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, speaking of England, I mean, when you guys, I think that's when we talked to you last, when you guys did the Royal Albert Hall and just how big you guys were over there, are over there, and how amazing the reception's been. Is that still mind blowing? You know, you talk about guys from, you know, Kentucky, a totally different part of the world. And then, you know, halfway around the world, they're just blasting Blackstone Cherry. I mean, just huge fans over there. It must not get old thinking about that, right? Just how mind blowing that is.
Hell no, I don't get old. I sit here every day and I'm like, how does that work? How do people in France want to sit around and listen to Blackstone Cherry? Or how do people in England or Germany, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Hell, we were in high school, we couldn't get people in class with us to listen to us, let alone somebody in France, you know? And it's little stuff like that, man, that, you know, the business we're in, it's easy to get jaded and be like, I don't feel like doing this shit today. But you also got to remind yourself that 16-year-old you just starting a band, sitting in high school, trying to sell CDs to your friends, would have absolutely shat himself for any of the opportunities you get today.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. You know, so it's, you know, I've really, and especially since my dad passed, man, you know, it's, I've tried to take a new look at everything and try to appreciate everything a whole lot more than I used to.
Any thoughts on Grateful Dead just wrapped up like 2 days ago, last show. They played their last show ever. Again, I know you're a big fan of Zap, AC/DC, classic rock, Skynyrd.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that 60-year run from the Grateful Dead?
I mean, I've never been a Deadhead. And Jeff, they're super like jam bandy dudes. They love the Dead, all that kind of stuff. I have a huge appreciation and admiration for it, though. You know, it's like the closest I've ever got to that kind of world is Government Mule, stuff like that, where it's a little more rock-driven, a little heavier-driven. But no, man, look, you take something that Jerry started and Bob and those dudes, and they were able to continue it for that long. It's amazing, you know, and the level of musicianship that they always had floating around, you know, it's incredible. I think anything that can last and garner fans and still draw them out that many years, you did more than what you were set out to do, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah,
just timeless, right? Just
yeah, dude. I mean, look, I probably couldn't name you one song if I'm being completely honest. You know, I'm sure there's a Railroad song or something like that in there somewhere. With the jam band, there's a something song always is, but I'm more into like, I've always been this way, but I'm more into like a great song and less of a great jam. Mm-hmm. I've always been that way though. You know what I mean? Like even some of the clips of, you know, Zeppelin where Dazed and Confused goes 28 minutes. I'm like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I love a good jam, but damn, let's don't go too far with it.
Yeah, right.
Look, we've been guilty of it. I saw a video of us one time where we did a 12-minute version of a song, and I was like, Chris, what the fuck is wrong with you? Nobody wants to hear a 12-minute version of that song. It's the truth.
Yeah. Do you think John Mayer did a nice job filling in for Jerry? Are you a big fan? Fan of his playing? Look,
John Mayer is one of those guys that, love him or hate him, he is one of the most astounding musicians of a generation, you know? And for me, like, I really like a lot of his stuff. My favorite record he ever did, though, was that Born and Raised record. There was just about that record. I don't know why. I could just put it on, and it made me feel like I was driving through the desert in Arizona, you know? And it, I don't know, man. It just, that record is a vibe. It's one of those records that you just put on, and it's a vibe from start to finish.
Yeah. Like a whole atmosphere. Yeah. That's like, that's one of those things. Like, it's great when you hear like awesome songs, but then when you've got like a whole atmosphere going or something or a vibe, it's like, it's a whole nother level, man. You know?
Yeah, dude. Absolutely. And that's something I love about Gary Clark Jr. If we're talking about guitar players, man, it's every Black and Blue was like, it sounded really modern and polished, but it was like these great songs. And then every record since then, he's gone into the studio going, I'm going to make this kind of record. And that the record is a vibe. The minute you put it on, it sets a tone and you're like, this is where I'm living for the next hour to hour and 20 minutes, however long this LP runs. This is where I'm at, because that's just what you want to do, man.
Right. Yeah, man.
I'm not going to get into this specific person, you guys don't write a lot of political songs, and that seems to be a very divisive thing these days, especially with fan bases. Any thoughts on, I know John previously talked about this before, and John Fred talked about this stuff before. Why do you steer away from that kind of, I mean, I think you do have songs that are overtly political, but not intentionally coming from one direction or another. Is that something you try to stay away from?
It's two reasons for me, really. Number one, I'm kind of with Alice Cooper on it. I think it was him that said it, that rock stars shouldn't be telling people how to vote or anything like that, you know. I just like religion, you know. I'm entitled to believe and act as I please, just like anyone else in this country is entitled to believe and act as they please. I'm not here to tell anyone what they should do one way or another, because at the end of the day, right wing, left wing, it's one bird, you know, realistically. You know, and then the other reason is, quite simply, if politicians ever started giving a fuck about people, then I'll give a fuck about them. But until they do and put that foot forward, out of sight, out of mind, I'm not singing about them, I'm not talking about them. Does that, until they actually start putting people first, you know? But, you know, it's the other way around. So I stay out of it because I have a hard time keeping my mouth shut. So I just stay out of stuff. You know what I mean? Because once I get to that spot, I just say whatever. And I'm like, you know.
As the lid comes off, it's like,
the gloves are gone.
I feel like music's a happy, like, I mean, for me, it's like rock.
It's an escape. One of those places.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a getaway. Yeah, to get away from the craziness. No, look, don't get wrong. Yeah.
I'll sing about awareness all day long. Look, if you look at Screaming at the Sky, that's that whole song is talking about, you know, being aware of everything that's going on, but also letting the shit that you can't control go, man. You know?
Yeah. Totally.
We all need some healing. Yep. I like that.
Thanks, sir. Yeah.
Kind of along those lines, I think you've talked about before, like the music generally comes first, right? You know, kind of setting a tempo. What's it, talk about that process. I mean, especially like when you know there's so much you want to say, but lyrically, but you kind of get the music to set the vibe first. How does that play out?
The music typically dictates a vibe, right? So like, It's just like anything, you know, you put on a record because you want to feel a certain way. When you're writing songs, it just kind of comes out, and then you sit back and listen to it once you're done. And then those feelings start to You know, what's it? What kind of feeling does it give you? What kind of vibe comes off of this to you? What kind of aura does this song, does this piece of music give you? You know, and then it'll come with a melody. Someone will have a melody, and then it'll typically be one line that starts a whole song. You know, and that line will either set up the entire lyric for the rest of the song, or it sets up the idea of what the song is about. And then you're off to the races from there, you know?
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. It's kind of hard to describe. It's kind of like learning how to walk. You don't remember how you learned how to walk, but you just know you can.
Right.
You know, it's the same kind of thing, you know? I don't know. It's the hardest thing to describe is how a songwriting session works or how it's written or stuff like that, you know, because it's so fast and then it can pause, you know, like there's been songs where the chorus was done and the music was there and you just stuck. So you just walk away, you know, it's because I'm the kind of person, like if we're working on a song and nothing's happening within 15 minutes, I'm on to the next thing or I'm going to do something else and come back to it. You know, writing a song shouldn't be that damn hard. It just shouldn't. Yeah. And, you know, but there's sometimes you got to walk away and come back and then it'll just strike. But a lot of times it happens really fast, man. Like it'll get going and then it's done.
Yeah.
Good. No, just, I'll skip that one, but I'm not going to, Miranda Lambert recently flipped out this week about fans spinning around, taking selfies, stuff like that. Chrissy Hynde's been very vocal about it. Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders. Any thoughts? Do you ever see cell phones going away from shows? Does it ever bother you? Do you think it distracts from the art?
Man, I was around. So we were touring back before people had their phones out all the time. You know,
those were the days.
We've been fortunate enough to do that, but I also look at it like this, man. Like, not every single person there with their phone out is just doing it to post on their Instagram story to look cool. Some of those people that are there worked all fucking year to have one night to get to go out and do something.
Yeah.
And if they want to take a picture of themselves with their friends while I'm singing a pretty song, please do it. Please take all the pictures you
want. Right on.
Please video anything you want to do. We have always had a policy at our shows of you can film whatever the fuck you want. You can take pictures of whatever you want, as long as there's no flash. We just ask that you don't come in. If you can bring in your pro camera and stand in the pit, that all that shit is on the venues or the bands we're touring with, right? If it's a Blackstone Cherry show, I don't care if you come in with the same. I've got a Canon R5, a really nice camera. I've got really nice lenses. I don't care if you walk in with the same setup I've got and take pictures of our band all night long from the crowd. I do not care. I'll just be honest. To stop a show because three girls were taking selfies and not watching you sing for 30 seconds is ridiculous, in my opinion. Like, those people paid for a ticket. They didn't pay for a ticket just to hear you sing. They paid for a ticket in that venue and that seat to do what they want to in that seat. So if they want to stand there and scream at you until they get kicked out, they bought the seat. I've had people scream at me until I had them removed from the venue. They paid for their seat and they got their money's worth. They got to be seen by everybody in the damn venue, you know, just like I was. But I just think it's ridiculous for people to get pissed off or someone taking a selfie at a concert. Maybe Miranda Lambert was that girl's favorite artist and they wanted a selfie during that song that they could always remember while she was singing this one song. They got their picture at her show to remember that night. And Miranda, like, wasn't really nice tone about it, you know? It's just like, there's been another video surfaced where she punched a hole in a beach ball or something. People were kicking around, having fun in the crowd, you know, bouncing, and said the same thing. We're not doing that. We're playing country music. I get that, but I'm pretty sure that it's okay to take a picture at a concert, man. Like, I don't understand, you know, and I'm not condemning anyone. She has every right. Miranda has every right to feel whatever way she wants to. But for the record, for Blackstone Cherry, take all the selfies you want of you and your buddies. You know, the only thing that's ever disheartening to me is when we're playing and someone's like this on the front row all night looking at their phone. Like that's disheartening. Like, yeah. And all I'll say is I'll call the person out and be like, damn, are we that boring? Like, do I need to work harder? And the person will laugh 9 times out of 10. They'll put their phone up and actually participate in the show a little bit. But I'm not going to do it in a mean way.
Right.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
well, yeah, no, that's totally different. You're right. Yeah.
Go ahead. The people in the room are the only reason you get to do what you do. Don't be mean to them for taking a selfie. Shit.
No, like you said, I mean, it could be their first concert too or something, or, you know, they went through something really crappy and that's like the one salvation or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If I was in a band too, I'd love to see footage to see how we were looking, how we sounded. You know, that feeling.
Natural sound, yeah.
The vibe.
Every night I look before I go to bed to see if there were any videos posted to Facebook or Instagram or YouTube of the show, because I want to see if we sounded good. I want to see how the show looked, all that stuff, you know. Yeah. And, dude, because in the States, we're doing, you know, clubs most of the time. So I want to know what the PA sounded like in the room, you know. That way when we go back, we know how to mix it again, stuff like that. You know, I love it. I love the fact that people will get phones out and record, you know. Because realistically, if you're engaging the crowd very much, they're not going to have their phone out the whole time anyways. You're going to have them clapping or have their fist in the air, have them dancing or singing along. You know, it's like, embrace it. Embrace it and do something cool with it, you know?
Yeah. As a performer, I always wonder this with artists. You know, you do a show, how you mentioned kind of looking at the video to see how you sound after. Is that a nerve-wracking process sometimes? I mean, can it be like an obsessive thing where you worry about how things went, because it's just, you know, you're putting your soul out there. I mean, I always wonder, for any artist, you know, how tough is that? Or is it just you kind of look at it, take notes, and just keep move on to the next thing?
I used to be super, super hard on myself.
Yeah.
And now, you know, like, man, we're a band. We don't use any backing tracks. We don't play to a metronome. Every now and then we'll use a metronome live. Like, if we notice we've been playing a song super fast, we'll play it a night or two to a metronome just to get the tempo closer back, or we'll sound check it with a metronome. But, like, John Fred and Steve are the only two that use ears every single night. So metronome doesn't even work for us most of the time, because me and Ben don't even use in-ears. We just use old school wedges. You know, I use in-ears on big festivals and stuff, but, like, we don't play to any kind of backing tracks. There's no laptop on stage, none of that. And over the years, I feel like I've gotten better as a live singer. But now when I look at something, I'm like, and if I hit a bad note, I'm like, ooh, shit, I need to work on that one, Chris. You know, just make sure to take note of that one and make sure that, you know, we don't miss that note again, you know. But now I watch stuff and I'm like, it's not necessarily for the performance. It's more for sonics and interaction between, like, what can I improve with my talking with the crowd, or, you know, what can we do to make the show tighter, or, you know, what can we extend or loosen up here? Stuff like that.
Screaming at the Sky coming at you September, late September 29th, I think. Dude, thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Man. Thank you guys.
Yep.
Thank you, Chris.
Have a good one.
You too.
You too.
Yeah.